Well, today we are blessed to have a special guest with us, a man that needs no introduction. And this is a follow-up of a very important interview that we did on the past, present, and future of chiropractic in the September issue of the American Chiropractor. The champion for chiropractic, Dr. Lou Sportelli. Dr. Sportelli, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice. It's really nice to be here.
No, it's great to be here.
And by the way, I got really some very, very nice notes from doctors all over the country after reading that September issue. They there were some really nice comments from folks across the nation. So it just goes to show you that folks are reading or and then some of them even saved the cover, you know, for target practice.
Well, those we would like to hear more about those, the feedback from those people. No, you know what? It's really it rekindles a lot of memories from, you know, me myself, just having been doing the magazine with Jacqueline over the last 20 years. I mean, your experience spans 40 years. Some of the battles that you've done, I mean,
60.
No, wait. Dr. Joe's saying 40 because there is something that we just found the other day.
I remember that one. Oh my God. I actually forgot about it, but I do remember it now.
1983, oh. Doc. There was a grace the cover of the American Chiropractor. So,
well, we threw away the ones that we had target practice.
Well, that's good. I'm glad that makes me feel a lot better, Joe. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
so, but I mean, this montage of photos that you submitted with this article was incredible. You know, you got time on here. You've got some of the history when you're participating with the creation of the World Federation of Chiropractic. And I just think that many people didn't realize how involved you were with and have been and still are with the growth of chiropractic to the point it is today, you know. So as we covered in this interview, what were some of the highlights in your mind that stick out that really made you feel like, wow, I feel like with that, I made a big difference in not only, you know, the business of chiropractic, the growth of chiropractic, but the world?
Well, you know, it's funny, Joe, when the issues that need to be confronted are in front of you, I mean, you just never think about any of this. You just think about how you're going to solve them and what is it that you need to do to resolve whatever the conflict or issue of the moment. And it's only after it's done and hopefully successfully that you're able to kind of stop for a minute and look back and say, oh, gee, that was a pretty important thing. And I don't care whether it was early on in the Wilk involvement with the profession suing the AMA, or whether it was the Blue Shield litigation in Pennsylvania, or it was the establishment of the World Federation of Chiropractic. None of those at the time, I mean, you just had a group of folks who got together and said, you know, here's an issue confronting us. Mm-hmm. Let's see what we can do to resolve it. And then after it's resolved, you look back, you know, in hindsight and are able to look at it. But you never start out doing anything with that kind of a thought process in mind. So I will tell you that I don't think anybody who tells you, yeah, this is what I thought about when I first started, the history unfolds, and then you can look back, and that's really the authentic kind of history that you get.
Well, you know, I wanted to jump in and say, because honestly, the first question that comes to me really that, you know, there's not even the space in the magazine to address, but How did it, when you started with NCMIC, how did it start out? And did you ever have an idea that it'd grow to the size that it has come to today?
Those are great questions. How did it start out? It started out very tumultuously. obviously there was a lot of, it was essentially overthrowing a group that was involved not, in my estimation, doing a terribly good job. And it had been sort of historical that, you know, NCMIC and FCLB and a number of other places were dumping grounds for, you know, old leadership. You know, that's kind of the place where they go, you know, to either die or whatever. I'm not sure. But they really weren't doing a good job with the organization. And I saw that I happened to have been involved in a portion of that very early on. And it got me interested in the malpractice aspect because in Pennsylvania, the attorney general in Pennsylvania stopped companies from writing chiropractors simply because there was a technicality of what's called the long arm statute, and they weren't, apparently they had missed paying some fines and so forth. And so I got involved in it in the state to try to get them covered, try to get them reinstated. And as a result of that, my interest kind of peaked in the malpractice aspect. And so when we got involved with it, NCMIC, I looked at the issues, and we basically kind of overturned over a number of years, overturned the old board. And as I looked at it from a businessman's perspective, nothing else. I mean, it was the fact that how is this company that is simply going to be all chiropractors, how are they ever going to essentially know and understand all of the things? That's not what we were trained to do. We were trained to care for sick people, and we were trained to be chiropractors. And so there's a skill set that's required in finance. There's a skill set required in management. There's a skill set required in every one of the aspects of running a business. And essentially, in my view, the breakthrough came in 1999 when I got the board to essentially agree that we needed public members on our board. And after we got public members on our board, we got people in finance, people in management, people with this banking, people in the skill sets that were missing. NCMIC took off because we knew what the profession needed. We just didn't have the skill sets to provide it. And once we got the public members on board, the company just simply took off. And fortunately, we had great management during the next number of years, and we've got fantastic management today. So while the management of the company are not DCs, DCs at heart, they know exactly, they haven't lost their mission. And NCMIC was really kind of never about money. NCMIC was always about essentially our simple slogan: we take care of our own. And so how do we take care of our own? Well, we take care of our own by looking at what the profession needed. They needed loans. They needed credit cards. They needed insurance of all kinds for their automobiles. They needed house insurance. They needed malpractice. They needed to be cared for, essentially, as a viable professional. And nobody was looking at them that way. And so that's kind of where we were at the situation. That's where we were at, really, looking at NCMIC. That's a great question, because frankly, if the NCMIC had remained all chiropractors, I don't know where we would be today, if we would be at all.
Well, that's a really important point that you're making. As chiropractors, we do tend to group together. We believe that we can solve our own issues. Sometimes, a lot of times, we lack the understanding of the intricacies of the law and our limitations based on that. And don't it?
Well, you know, Joe, you've been involved long enough to know that chiropractors think they're their own public relations people, they're their own lawyers. That's the kind of mentality. And frankly, early on in the mid 20th century, we didn't have the economics or the wherewithal to kind of go out and seek those. So every once in a while, we found somebody. Thankfully, McAndrews was one of those. We found somebody who understood the profession, but also had the skill sets in the legal community to take on a major undertaking. So you're absolutely correct. And I don't care what company or what organization you're talking about. If it's all one group, it'll never break out of its success, because it won't know what it doesn't know.
That's amazing insight, really, like that we don't know what we don't know. And all of us chiropractors all looking inward, you know, like that's been the big thing we've always been hearing, is that chiropractors tend to be their own worst enemies, fighting each other. And there's a whole big planet of people who need chiropractic help. You know,
I mean, absolutely.
That's a really great insight.
Well, just pulling a quote out of your interview, you said the hardest thing about being a chiropractor was not knowing why there was opposition. And I think that kind of cuts to the heart of it. You know, it's like, we're there, we just want to help people, you know, but we don't know where, you know, maybe our role ends and another one has turf wars with us and the politics behind it, you know, which I'm not saying we need to necessarily respect the politics behind helping patients. But, you know, having those external voices would help us understand a lot better.
No question. It brings, that's why people, whether you're in a marital dispute, mm-hmm. or a financial dispute, what do? They go to a third-party arbiter, mm-hmm. because somebody from the outside can always see with incredible clarity what the issue is. But the people involved have very difficulty seeing it because they get emotionally tied. So I've learned a long time ago is always to go from to an outside source that's independent, mm-hmm. and what you have confidence in. But that's how you get issues solved. Is you see, first you have to identify the problem, mm-hmm. and if you don't identify the problem, it'll never get resolved. And it's hard to identify the problem if you're part of the problem. hard to be the solution if you're part of the problem. Well, why third party always manages to do. To provide a level of clarity that internally you can't do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, Jacqueline, was there anything specific you wanted to ask Dr. Sportelli now that we have him here live and in the flesh?
Everything. Are you kidding? I want to get everything Dr. Sportelli knows out of his brain to make sure that we can carry it forward.
So the next 50 years internationally, we kind of asked you about this question, and you've had an important role in it. You mentioned how now there are more chiropractors outside of the United States than within the United States.
And there are, yeah. And so more university, not chiropractors, but more universities, more chiropractic colleges outside the U.S. mm-hmm. than there are inside. And the interesting part of that, Joe, is that there is no question, and that is we've established essentially the credibility of the profession. Thankfully, through the early research efforts of people like Scott Haldeman and people like Christine Gertz and Rubenstein, those are the folks that in the early days of research, they were just scratching the surface, and everything has been built upon that early research. Mm-hmm. So what happened is people started looking and saying, you know, all right, if you remember, you're long enough here in the profession to remember when subluxations were figments of chiropractors' imaginations. I mean, that was it. They didn't exist, and so that's what the medical community was talking about, and that's what the scientific community was talking about. Chiropractors were really out there in loony land. Mm-hmm. Well, now we've come full circle. And matter of fact, I say full circle, Joe, because I've been practicing 60 years, okay? Now, I didn't understand when patients were coming to me. I didn't have the foundational knowledge to, they mostly came in with back problems and neck problems. That's what they came in for early. But as a result of treating them, other things began to improve. Their sleeping improved, their digestion improved, their asthma improved, their headaches improved. So all of those things, but remember now, we're talking about the early 60s. And I ironically, I have a marker, and the marker's 1963. That's when I graduated from that's when I started my practice. I graduated in 62 and I started my practice in 63. And lo and behold, the American Medical Association started their Committee on Quackery in 1963 to contain and eliminate us.
Wow.
In a very clandestine way. So there's a direct marker, mm-hmm. in my world about that date. Mm-hmm. So back then, of course, we had no foundational basis. We had no credibility. But as a practitioner, people were coming to us out of desperation. They had failed everything else. And so they were looking, I mean, when you think about the fact that the courage it took a patient to go to a chiropractor in the 60s, right. was incredible, because their medical physician would threaten not to take care of them. They were afraid of everything. And so they're going to a profession that was synonymous. And I always like to do this. If you play word games, word association games, in the 1960s, chiropractic was associated with the word quack. They did a wonderful job of planting that seed in the public's mind. So now you have a patient who's hurting, been everywhere they could be at the time. And so now they're going to anger their medical physician and go to a quack. I mean, think about the courage and the pain those patients had to be in order to go to a chiropractor. So they would come to us, and a lot of these things were resolving, and thankfully so was their musculoskeletal problems. Well, now, just recently, there has been a new study on spinal pain and comorbidities. We're talking about the comorbidities of diabetes and blood pressure and asthma. I mean, now we've come full circle. When I said that back in the 60s, it was like, you know, first of all, we didn't put it all together back then. But as we got a little smarter in the 70s, we said, you know, some people with asthma and this kind of stuff. And I say this only because most of you know that I was involved in the Black Lung Conference in Pennsylvania in the early 70s. Now, let me tell you, the governor of Pennsylvania had a tough governorship. He had in Pennsylvania, of course, you know, we're in the coal district. Well, he had been an advocate of chiropractic because a chiropractor had helped him get rid of his headaches and his back brace. So he was an advocate. He appointed somebody as a chiropractor involved in pneumoconiosis. And of course, the chiropractor made some statements. And of course, the governor wanted to make sure that he got his statements corroborated. So when he called and asked if I would lead a conference on pneumoconiosis, and I called some of the folks in our profession, I mean, none of them refused me, but they all thought I was nuts. I mean, and yet here I am. And I say this, why I went in there sort of naively blind, but naively optimistic, because we would treat those coal miners who came in with big barrel chests, would take an x-ray, you'd know that they had black lung, they couldn't even walk from the parking lot into your office without being totally and completely out of breath. And you treat them for a few months, and the next thing you know, they're walking for blocks feeling great. And so you come in, you take another x-ray, nothing changed. It was nothing to do with the x-ray or what was appearing on the x-ray. It was a functional situation that we know that we restored something to enable them to have the ability to walk a couple blocks. Now, the patient didn't give a damn, neither did I. All I knew was that they were feeling good. So when the governor said, how about doing a conference on pneumoconiosis? I knew damn well that we helped a lot of the miners in our area. I live in a coal mining area. And so as a result of that, we put on the pneumoconiosis conference, the Black Lung, and thankfully many of the folks in our profession today, you know, who were called back then, didn't hang the phone up on me. They basically said, well, you know, there's this, I can remember Dr. Jancy being ever so diplomatic, saying, well, there's a paucity of evidence, but, you know, we'll see what we can put together. And then Dr. Haldeman and a whole host, Dr. Winterstein, a whole host of other folks came together, and we put the conference on. It was successful. And so that's, you know, when you think about when I think about this stuff, I mean, I look over a 60-year span, and I'm saying, here I was considered, you know, sort of nuts in the 60s, saying people with asthma and headaches and blood pressure and all that stuff could be helped. And here in 60 years later, we're now starting to study the comorbidities associated with spinal pain. I mean, it's wonderful. It is absolutely a wonderful situation to be able to see the progress that's occurred. Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm forever optimistic. As a matter of fact, more so than I've ever been.
Oh, that's amazing.
I love to hear the enthusiasm. Absolutely. I feel it too. And as now I've been a chiropractor practicing for about the last 15 years. And so we're in Latin America, you know, so it's a different kind of vibe than it is in the United States, which had such a controlled kind of form of communication, this top down industrial medical complex telling people what to do and like the quackery. But down here, there's a real openness to the idea of natural health and healing. So, I mean, they love the chiropractic approach and understand that the body can heal itself. So just like you, as you see patients get better, I mean, it just kind of makes you more enthusiastic every time you see it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And Dr. Sportelli, I want to jump in because I know that you're doing, tell us where this office you have. It looks like a chiropractic clinic behind you. I know you're not,
it's a private office, actually, and this is where the work gets done. You know, if you notice, my love of books, the bookshelf you see behind me, there's three of them like that, and so books have been a major part of my life, and I matter of fact, when I send you a book on occasion, Jacqueline, you notice on the inside of the cover there is a wonderful little sticker, and it's was a dear friend of mine. That's Charlie Tremendous Jones, and Charlie basically said, you're the same person today you were 5 years ago, except for two things: the people you meet and the books you read. And how insightful and true that is. And I just think books have been a major part of my life, and have been influential, along with some mentors, but influential in how I thought and what made me think the way I do, which is kind of outside the box.
Amazing. Well, and I had asked about that too, because I was curious, how many years did you practice as a chiropractor?
I practiced for 40 years.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing.
And then I took on another career with NCMIC for another 25. And now I'm involved in our NCMIC Foundation, the Research Foundation.
I mean, so what does a regular day look like for you now?
Well, I must confess, I'm sort of only working half days now, the first 12 hours.
As it should be. You're entitled. You don't have to work at all, actually.
I love what I do, and I never really felt that I worked at all.
Well, don't ever stop. I mean, that's the quick.
I don't plan to, Joe, unless the good Lord decides that I can do something better. I'm not sure.
Don't stop now. So, well, no, and so what else? What new projects do you have on the horizon? You mentioned you're with the Research Foundation. Are we looking at any new research?
Well, yes. Matter of fact, if those of systematically, and I say this because if you look at any time you look at a problem that's confronting us, I mean, I can see, and it's oftentimes, Joe, it's interesting to know your history. Because your history provides the roadmap for tomorrow. And I say that for this reason. I have the documents that show chiropractors who were DC PhDs couldn't get a publication printed in a peer-reviewed journal. The journal would leave off their DC if they would put on their PhD, or they would write to them and say, no, I'm sorry, we can't publish your research, no matter how good it is, because you're a chiropractor. I mean, think about that kind of mindset and that kind of bias and prejudice in an area that should have no bias at all, which is research. It should be 100% investigative and 100% open to change, but it wasn't, Joe. Mm-hmm. So when I look at that, I say, okay, what are our barriers to entry? Our barriers to entry were that we didn't have a whole lot of researchers in the chiropractic field that were DC PhDs. So if you don't have the qualifications, then you're going to wind up with barriers to entry. So what we did over a long period of time, we realized that we needed to help DCs who wanted to become PhDs. Well, the foundation has now essentially helped, I think, my members should be off of one or two. I think it's close to 50 or 52 DCs that we have helped with their PhDs. That's number one. So once you got the DC PhD in a variety of areas, from epidemiology to basic research to policy to whatever. So then, okay, what's the next level? So we have chiropractic colleges now. And the chiropractic colleges, so now how do we break into other arenas? Well, we had an opportunity, this is now about 10 years ago, we had an opportunity to affiliate with the University of Minnesota. And two of our top researchers, Dr. Ronnie Evans and Dr. Gert Bronfert, went over to the University of Minnesota. They are now a tenured faculty there. And during the 10 years that they were with the university, which we didn't lose them to the profession, they basically built a cadre of chiropractic and chiropractic researchers, they have already, if my memory serves me right, I could be off a little bit, but I think they've gotten so far about $24 million in NIH grants to study spine and spine-related situations, which has enabled them to now affiliate with other colleges like the University of Pittsburgh, Dartmouth, Yale, and Harvard. Well, then the Yale and Harvard piece, if I had to ask you again in a word association, what would you say would be the two top academic institutions in the United States? Which ones would you say? I mean, I think we'd be pretty safe to say it'd be Harvard, Yale, Stanford. You know, those would be the ones that you'd kind of say right off the top of your head without thinking. Right. Well, so fortunately for us, we had some DCs who, like Anthony Lisi, who became involved not only with the VA program and catapulted that into the stratosphere, but he was also affiliated with Yale. We had Matt Kowalski, who was affiliated with Harvard in the Osher Center. Well, they had been there a decade or more, and the opportunity for a fellowship came up in both of those institutions. Well, okay, you can do all, people can say all they want to, but where's the funding coming from? Well, the funding came, we needed funding, and you can't, I mean, listen, you can brag all you want, but without money, nothing works. I mean, you know, that's the whole problem. I mean, it's and how do you utilize the money most effectively? Well, that was a barrier to entry in my view, in my world. And so we tried to do everything we could do to accommodate the opportunity that existed. So now we have a DC and a fellowship position at Yale. We have a DC and a fellowship position at Harvard. We have DCs in faculty positions at University of Minnesota. The University of Pittsburgh is now going to start its chiropractic program next year. So think about what has transpired in terms of the growth and the credibility of the chiropractic profession in credible research institutions.
Right.
And break the barriers. You break the barriers by not only opening the door, but then demonstrating that you could stay there. And we have, I'll tell you, there's a number, a cadre of young DCs who are absolutely going to blow the lid off of what we think can be accomplished. That's how we look at everything, Joe. We look at what are the barriers to entry, and then how do we overcome those barriers? Mm-hmm. That's the way we look at and solve most every problem that we have.
Well, this is the stuff that people out there need to know, that you're doing so much on this side, you know, and getting into these public institutions and private institutions, and we're getting the NIH money from there. You know, sometimes everyone feels the need to like donate their, you know, $1,000, which represents maybe a week's work towards some of these research projects. But knowing that at least we're getting into the government, and they're starting to support those programs through these.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, Joe, because here's the key. Years and years ago, today, for example, if you apply for an NIH grant, mm-hmm. you will not get a grant right off the bat unless you've done sort of a pilot study. Mm-hmm. So it's the funding of the pilot study. In other words, here's your theory, here's your hypothesis. Okay, show me that you think it's going to work. And that little pilot study, the pilot study may cost anywhere from $50,000 to $500,000, depending upon what you're doing.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the $1,000 to the foundations and these institutions, that's where that money becomes incredible. Mm-hmm. So once you put out the pilot study money, mm-hmm. and then you apply for your big NIH grant, which then comes into the millions. But without evidence and without some support to essentially validate a little bit of your hypothesis, you're never going to get any funding. And that's why it's so critical that the chiropractors still contribute to the foundation, because the foundation is what provides the seed money.
Well, we need mm-hmm. that PR out there so they can see the fruits of that, you know, and make sure that we're always sharing that with our readers, you know.
I say this, for example, you're absolutely right. For example, the story at the University of Minnesota is a wonderful fairy tale to tell. And I'm sure if you interviewed Ronnie Evans and Gert Brodfort, they would be absolutely thrilled to talk about that. And I don't know if you've interviewed Matt Kowalski and Peter Wayne from Osher, or if you've interviewed Anthony Lisi, and even the young lady who just went through the program.
Right.
I mean, here's another one, for example. The National University of Health Sciences in Chicago has just got an affiliation agreement with the Minnesota Orthopedic Institute, where they're sending their two students for 16 or 18 weeks. Dr. Joe Stifel would be a good one to interview, and so would Jeff Miller. Why? Because they put that program together, and now the people coming out of those programs, Joe, have had a worldwide eye-opening event that will change their view forever.
Absolutely.
Because of the opportunity.
I love it. And we've interviewed quite a few of those, not all of them. And we got some more on the, you know, on the back burner. So those are coming around. But the University of Minnesota gentleman, we had not engaged. And so I definitely.
Well, if you want, when we're done here, I will certainly send you her email.
Okay. Or a gentlewoman, I should say then.
Well, I was going to say, because we can keep going on, and I want to pick your brain on everything. I was like, okay, so what about the colleges on the college forefront? How do you see the schools? You know, are we doing well educating chiropractors? I mean,
well, yes. The answer to that is yes and no. how are the colleges doing? The colleges themselves are doing fantastic. Matter of fact, you know, I remember when some of these colleges looked like penal institutions, if you know, that had bars on the windows to prevent the students from leaving, I think. But I mean, when you look at our campuses today, I mean, just look at what Palmer has just recently done with its campus. It's unbelievable. But and look at what Logan has done. Look at what Cleveland has done. I mean, when I think back over the last 60 years that I have been to every one of these institutions and saw what they were and saw what they are now, I mean, it's just absolutely marvelous. The students have a brick and mortar environment that is absolutely wonderful for their educational experience. If I have one concern at all, the concern I have is that are we teaching, is our institutions, are they preparing the graduates for the chiropractic entry 10 years from now? Because as you see between what's happening with AI and what's happening with institutions, it's what's happening in the change of education, and what's happening with the opportunities, for example, in federally qualified health plans, in hospitals, and all of those are going to be a changing environment that you have to be prepared for. And I don't want us to be preparing taxi drivers entering an Uber world.
Well, it's a valid concern, you know, but the nice thing about chiropractic is you need your hands. So the AI, you know, on the back end, perhaps for the triage and whatnot, but I'm sure that some apparatus will come along that does some AI manipulation, but
AI is going to come. It'll come in very different forms. You're right. We're a long way off to replace somebody who utilizes their hand, Joe. But what the AI will do will be enhance our diagnostic capacities,
right.
Without a doubt. And I'm sure that there's going to be new genetic biomarkers that are going to be able to differentiate the person who is a better chiropractic potential than somebody who is not, or will be able to differentiate things that maybe should be reviewed first before they enter chiropractic. I mean, the potential of the diagnostic aspect, in my view, is not only unlimited, but it will enhance the ability of the DCs to accept the patients that they can accept. You want to make sure you have selected those listen, that's the success of a good surgeon, whether it's a brain surgeon or an orthopedic surgeon, is to select the patients that they know are mm-hmm. appropriate for their intervention. And if you select the wrong patient, you're going to have a wrong outcome.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so we need to be able to use AI in its proper fashion to be able to differentiate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have another question or two, actually. I was thinking, and I don't know if you'll be able to answer them or not, but I was thinking with malpractice insurance, overall malpractice cases, is there certain ones that are, that you notice that are types of cases that are more recurring right now? Has it changed much over the years? Is it pretty, on par with normal?
Well, that's a great question, Jackie. And I will tell you that the 90s was a real problem for chiropractors, because if you guys will remember, there had been a few spectacular stroke cases. And it was just a fearful situation. Don't touch my neck. Every chiropractor stroke everybody that they touch. And that's what the press was talking about. And we were, so here again, Joe, same kind of mindset. So what did we do? Fortunately for us, Dr. Scott Haldeman in 1999 basically said, okay, we're entering the decade of the bone and joint. We should really do a musculoskeletal intervention with neck and spine. Well, now think about this. Is 99. How much is it going to cost, Scott? He thought it was going to be about $3 million. Now, $3 million in 1999 dollars is probably $6 million in today's dollar. Well, we didn't have that kind of discretionary money to put out. Fortunately, NCMIC put up 3/4 of it. Canadian Protective Association, who was going to be, who's essentially the malpractice carrier in Canada, put up the other 25%. So we wound up with enough seed money, and then Scott was able to get money from other folks. But what happened was it turned out that particular investment created, if you will recall, the neck pain task force. And as a result of the neck pain task force and Dr. David Cassidy's involvement, we finally understood the mechanism of stroke. We finally understood the issues surrounding stroke. And so therefore, when the stroke cases actually came about, we were able to defend them based upon sound research that nobody else had done. Matter of fact, I don't know if you have a copy of it, but I don't know. There was two full publications, one in Spine and one in the European Spine Journal, of the entire process, the entire documents, all of the papers. As a result of that, Jackie, you can't, there's an old expression in law that says, when you have the facts, you pound on the jury. When you don't have the facts, you pound on the table. Well, without the facts, we were pounding on the table. We didn't have the evidence to support an incredible defense. And as a result of that, obviously, we wanted to be able to provide the best defense we could for our policyholders. And fortunately, today, we have 42,000 doctors of chiropractic as insureds on NCMIC, because they know that we have the best legal defense SWAT team. We have the best evidence. And there's no question about the fact that our ability to defend was predicated on our investment in research.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, and that dovetails in that.
Go hand in hand. Are the cases any different? Not really. The stroke cases was the biggest, incendiary issue. But for the rest of them, they're modest. Everybody thinks that everything should come out perfect. And unfortunately, even if the doctor doesn't do anything wrong, some cases, there's no question about the fact that there was an improper issue. You break somebody's rib or whatever the case may be, you're certainly, that's certainly grounds for some issue of malpractice. But for the most part, the issues are pretty vanilla. cases. I, you know, people didn't think that they got the kind of result they have. And of course, the facts are now, and you remember, and I say this, let me say this to you, which will sound like a shock. And that is that one of the worst things that happened to the profession and one of the best things that happened to the profession was managed care. Now, why I say that, because managed care killed us economically, but what it forced most DCs to do was to keep records. I mean, up until the 90s, when managed care came in, you could write a year's worth of care on the back of a postage stamp. I mean, that's the kind of records where we didn't really care much about records. Managed care forced us not only to provide decent records, but also the issue of informed consent became front and center. And so now I don't think there's a DC who practices that doesn't have decent records in either an electronic form or whatever, and also doesn't at least provide the best informed consent they can to their patients. So those are the things that have been learned and evolved over time, and attorneys helped to mold that, and so did the reimbursement mechanisms help to do that, and so did the educational qualifications of the college.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, and one of this is always near the end, but I always have to ask too, coming out of what we saw happening through COVID from a malpractice standpoint, I mean, and we know chiropractors are so completely divided from, you know, such extreme belief systems and everything. So I was curious to hear from your guys' perspective, if that ever had any impact on malpractice itself.
It didn't see, I don't have 100% of that answer, Jackie, but I don't believe that there was much of a blip in the differential for, because we weren't really involved in most of that at all as a profession. But I'll tell you what it did do. Look at the flip side. I'm always looking at the flip side. What the flip side did for COVID and for the American people is it basically got them to understand that there is an immune system, mm-hmm. and that the natural immunity was a powerful, powerful issue relative to the ability to combat the COVID, and that it was the vulnerable people that were the most affected, the healthy people who had a decent, so the immune system idea and consciousness over lifestyle, taking care of yourself. They knew that overweight and diabetes had and comorbidities of that nature were detrimental. So what it did, it raised the consciousness in my mind of healthy living that would have not happened in almost any other way. So I believe that the spin effect post-COVID is going to be an extremely positive situation for people who do not want to be in the medical the medical pendulum, you know, that keeps spinning all the time.
You're absolutely right. I think it caused people to question even the, you know, top-down orders they've been getting from their, you know, primary care or whatever.
And if you've been reading, listen, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to have some reservations. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there was evidence, and the evidence is now starting to come out, about the fact that many of these things that we were told were not true, from masks on down. And what do you do? And so we're seeing the negative effects. Some chiropractors were naturally opposed to a lot of things, but were they wrong? The bottom line is that there were chiropractors who said, you know, we shouldn't probably close our schools. Well, you know what? In retrospect, they were probably right. The harm we've done to our children by closing the schools and wearing masks, and that's their learning mechanism. They haven't, many of them didn't see their teachers' faces for 2 years. Yeah. The wrong or right is not black or white at all, but it is what's rational and reasonable and definable that we can now look back retrospectively and say, you know what, we could have done something different, and are we going to when the next issues come? And everything is not a pandemic. I'm sorry, it just isn't.
We agree. Wow. This is excellent to be able to be here with you. And now we got to do this every year, Dr. Sportelli.
Well, I'll be happy to do it. Then you can test my memory. See if it's failing or not.
Exactly right.
I started thinking you might have enough material for every month.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to do this, Joe, only because you're right. There's a lot of these things that occur, and the chiropractors who are practicing are doing a great job in their offices. But you know, when you go to your office and you practice, and then you have a family, and if you're involved a little bit, there's not a heck of a lot of time for a lot of other stuff. And so a lot of this information, unless it comes to them in some kind of package or some kind of a easily accessible situation, the chiropractors who are just good practitioners doing their stuff every day, they miss it. They don't have time for this. Yeah. I have an absolute advantage of looking at our world from 30,000 feet. And you know, you can see the world looks different when you're looking down at 30,000 feet. You can connect some dots. You can see where things are happening much better than you can on the ground. And so that's the advantage I have, is that as I'm able to look at the global perspective from where we are, in a very different viewpoint.
Well, we always have valued you guys with taking care of their own, because we always say we're walking the talk. We come from a family of chiropractors for chiropractors. So we resonate so much with everything that you guys do. And seeing you and your whole team at all of these events over all these years, Dr. Sportelli, I'm like,
First of all, I want to thank you also for the very kind interview and write up in September. That was very nice, and it did spark a couple of very fond memories and emails of from some folks all over the country who basically, some of them I cherish because they chided me a great deal. I just
love it.
Well, you know, good. Another thing, Jackie, when you look at some of that, I've kind of, you know, the fact that I ran for the House of Representatives and all of that kind of stuff, it just, you know, you kind of shake your head and said, how the hell did I do that stuff? Or where do I find the time, you know? But
I knew that.
You did.
It was awesome. Very, very cool.
I appreciate this, and I thank you.